So obviously, for purposes of argument, these two matters have been consolidated, and I think we've granted each of you up to 25 minutes. We're not going to chain you to the podium, so don't feel like you have to use every second of it if you don't need it. But you got 25 minutes apiece. Mr. Deal, would you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
What I'd like to do is 15 minutes on my case in chief and 4 minutes in rebuttal on my case, and then 6 minutes in response to his case. And I don't know how the batting order is going to be.
I think it's just going to be you going first and then Mr. Goff.
On his
and then
case.
You come back. Yeah.
Based on that, then, let me do 18 and 7.
Okay.
Thank you.
On behalf of my client, Judge, I will take 10 on our case and 15 on rebuttal.
Okay. Now, because these matters have been consolidated, we want to try to do this in a way that makes sure we still color within the lines. So we just want to make sure that your rebuttal concerns only your cross assignments of error and not any of Mr. Deal's, Mr. Henderson's original assignments of error.
Well, I want to do my strike. I want to respond to his 11 assignments of error, 15 for that, and then 10 for my client's 4. And I'm not going to reserve any additional rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Makes complete sense now. Right, Mr. Deal.
If Virginia did it in 0.9 seconds, we can do it in 50. Your Honor, I'm Lawrence Deal. I represent the appellant, William Henderson. The court may please the court. The first issue I want to address is the burden of proof relating to the classification of the Wells Fargo accounts 5889-7213. The accounts and the court, to do that, we need to find what did the fact finder find on that issue. He found that there was a sequence of numbers, that he traced the accounts from the pre-99-0410 to the accounts at the time of the hearing. And we've shown all of the sequence of those numbers. What he did not find was that there was any, he made no finding that marital funds were commingled with any of that. He kind of didn't know. But that gets into who has the burden based on that. So there was no finding that any marital funds were infused into those accounts at any time. The definition under 2107.3A1 of separate property is property that is proceeds in exchange for, and that's what we have. The only evidence of where the funds started was from Mr. Henderson's premarital bonuses and wages through the Green Bay Packers. And there was no other evidence of where that could have come from. So the court accepted his oral testimony about the sequence of these accounts, but somehow says, I'm not sure where the funds came from that funded those. Where else would it have come from? The evidence is clear in the record on that. So what does that mean on a burden of proof standard? We have a finding by the judge as a trier of fact that the links are there, the sequences are there. The only gap he talks about is values. But Gilman says once you have separate property, and that's what we have. In other words, we have the links. We have 0410 to the 02345 to the division, all in sequence, all documented. The fact that there's different values at different times isn't our burden to prove, because we know it's now linked and separate under the definition, and that there was no finding of commingling. If you look at a lot of the commingling cases, that's where you get into the shift of the burden. Once it's transmuted, it sounds like a blood disease, but once it's transmuted, that then puts the burden on the commingled account to prove, like Becerra and a few of those cases Rabahan, where there was one account, everything was commingled, it's kind of like a glacier that melts into the ocean, you can't put it back. Here, he kept it separate, which is part of the definition of separate property, never put her name on it, testified it was intended to only be used for a future savings. And at the end of the day, she's getting $1.3 million of $2.6 on those accounts based on premarital monies that she should have no at all basis on, only because the judge says, well, I don't know what dollar went in when. Whereas it should be the burden of proof under the Gilman case for the wife to have said, here's where the marital property was put in, and here's the marital share of that separate property. I invite you to ask Mr. Goff, under their exhibit P11, to name one traceable commingling of separate property that went into any of these accounts. They spent tons of time trying to show that, showing accounts that came out. But if you look at the two exhibits that show all of the ins and outs of those two accounts from 04 when it was rolled over, there was not one that matched that came from any marital account. Basically, he had a cap account, we call it, for his marital days. He put his wages in. They used it for the house. We have tracing on that. Both Mr. Smith, Mr. Henderson, and the documents were all show that there was no crossover on that. They tried, but speculation should not be the basis of a finding that these accounts are anything but separate. And by the fact that they were linked, and the court found that, that puts the burden on Mrs. Gilman, Mrs. Henderson, to have traced those out. So the burden of proof was incorrectly apportioned by the court, thereby placing Mr. Henderson in the position of having to prove, although we, even with the burden of proof that he had, if it is on him, we believe that we've shown the shift.
Mr. Deal, may I ask you, I may have diagrammed them out because there were a number of accounts, but is this the account where we had a missing period of time as far as any type of records? Is this the same account that we, because I believe the evidence suggested that either Wachovia or First Union, one of the banks didn't have records and you couldn't obtain them. Is this the same account or was that another account?
These are the same accounts, and the fact that there was no records of the balance is different from the finding that they were all linked. And there was never anything that is in the record that shows that 0410 that came when Wells Fargo got it in 2004 was any different from 0410, which is identified in 2003 1099s, 2001. So we have really 1 year of a link, but that doesn't mean that Mr. Henderson and Mr. Smith's testimony and the affidavit by stipulation of Alice White, or whatever her name was, who said it all came from this 0410 account, which clearly was before the marriage, because that's shown. We did everything we could to get what we had. And still, the court found that we had linked it. He didn't say that we didn't link it because of the gap. He said we didn't value it, but that's her burden. And that's the key thing here. It's all separate. And again, the commingling cases that you read talk about the burden of the owner of that account to show what's marital and what's separate. That's fine if it was commingled. But here, without a factual finding by the trier of fact, there was no finding that there was any marital commingling or transmutation, which would have changed the burden. I would concede that. But there's no finding in the record. And the court erred on that as a matter of law, which then affects the fact that the current balance hasn't been shown to be any marital share and should be his. We think that my brief, I think, shows all the other sequences and even meeting the burden. The burden of proof has to be not substantial evidence, but just reasonable evidence. Stand Back is the key case that talks about the level of the burden of proof. And it can be done on oral testimony. Mr. Henderson by himself testified that at all times that these were the only accounts that he used as a savings. He didn't use them for living. That was his cap account, which gets a little confusing because it's all under a big umbrella of 0410, but different sub-brokerage accounts. So the tracing between the two accounts after 2004, by the documents and by the testimony of both Mark Smith, who was the Wells Fargo advisor, and Mr. Henderson, was that there were some that just crossed over between them. They're both separate. Or that those formed two other accounts that kind of went back and forth for different investment purposes. But that's not evidence of any commingling of marital property because it still all came around. This chunk of brokerage accounts started as the source of the 72313 and 5889. Whereas there were some other accounts over here, that cap account that he used for the day-to-day living. The initial source of that was $1.2 million. That was his 99 salary. That was put into the cap account, kind of went back and forth, used for their house, very little balance at that. But nothing from the cap account ever was shown to go into the, which would be marital, ever was shown to go into the separate. There's not one iota of evidence. Court erred on that. Now, let me talk about the lien of the Wells Fargo equity line. There's about four errors on that.
That's 5889, Wells Fargo 5889.
Yes. Mr. Henderson decided to invest in Sweet Frogs up in Wisconsin. I guess people in Wisconsin don't like ice cream. Maybe it's a little too cold up there, but whatever. It went downhill. Did not make it. He got a line of credit loan of $1 million, and other than a small $40,000 that went to a car that she owns, it was all used for the construction and up startup costs of these Sweet Frogs. They went sour. He turned them back to the old owners, but there's still $1 million line of credit note. That note is a lien on the accounts of 5889, which is about a $2 million account. The judge, in his order, started out by saying, I'm giving Mrs. Henderson, and this is apart from the classification issue, which we're not waiving by this argument, but it's a lien on it. And Mark Smith said, I can't even convey that out if I'm ordered to give her half of that because it has to be paid. No question about the evidence being uncontradicted that it was a lien. All the documents showed it. Mark Smith showed it. So that was an error not to look at the net equity of any asset. We've shown many cases where they reversed it. Even an unsecured lien in Trivet. Trivet was a case way back where they basically said, well, there was a loan related to the real estate, but the court didn't consider it, even though it wasn't even a deed of trust as an attached lien. And they reversed the failure to have considered that in looking at the net equity. So if this court, for some reason, still says the 5889 is marital, the value should be the net value with a lien. Second error, the court said, I can't even divide it or transfer it because I don't know who owns it. I don't know if it's joint or not. Page 755, question to Mr. Smith, who did the loan and was the Wells Fargo. Who was the name of the lien in? It's in the name of Mr. Henderson. It's in the record. He just missed it. But that's not what we asked for, because we know you can't transfer a lien, a debt that's in the sole name. But the court failed to follow the statute under 1073C and go further and look at the apportionment. The court can apportion debts that are in either party's name. And he failed to apportion the debt or consider it, apart from the error of not finding that there was any joint or not. He didn't know. Well, it was in the record, so that's error as a fact, leading materially to his error in saying I couldn't even divide it because I don't know. But let's assume for a fact that it was in his name only. The court couldn't have transferred it. Got that. But he can apportion it, which is always what we do. Most recent ruling on that, I think is the Pence decision, if I'm not incorrect. Judge Decker was on the panel on that, which was a case where there was a, maybe wrong, I apologize for him, where there's a tax return filed solely by the husband that related, and taxes were owed because of a business they had, and the court ordered the wife, or at least factored in half of that loan because it was marital. And therefore, it was reversed for the failure of the court. It was affirmed on the court's apportionment on that, and that's similar to what we have here. The court here, as a factual finding, found that it was marital. Third error relating to that, or fourth error, is failure to consider 1073E7, the debt part of the statute. The findings for the apportionment or division are the same as for the property. It says in dividing up property and debts, the court shall consider our 12 or 13 factors. Well, he found, as a factual matter, and if you look at the substance of the division of everything, that everything would be 50-50. And without any even addressing it, he ignores the debt, which in effect, in substance, shifts it all to Mr. Henderson, whereas the application of those factors, without some way of saying why that should be different than the application of the factors to the property division, doesn't have any basis in the record, doesn't even address it in the record. He failed to either apportion it, and he failed to adjust it based on the findings that he used for the property, but not for that. Why should he be responsible for 100% of $1 million debt that the family got into? She did marketing for it. She made $93,000 one year doing branding and marketing for it. And that's just, I think, clearly reversible error. So
now, let me ask you this. Is your point, so if the account is then valued at a million and change, the next step would be for it to be remanded and the for the court to find it's a million and change, and then to do what?
Well, the only thing the court could apportion would be the net. If it's 50% of the net, it'd be to award her $500,000. The debt would have to be paid because the bank will not be able to distribute anything because they have a 2-to-1 ratio, as Mr. Smith explained. Like, you have to have twice as much in there. So to get $500,000 out of there, the debt's got to be paid off.
Right, and then
effectively, it leaves each with $500,000.
Well, the circuit court could divide it however the circuit court. I mean, if it's being remanded.
Yeah.
I mean, under the Garner case.
I don't disagree that they could look at it anew, but, you know, so far he's done everything 50-50, and maybe he won't like the fact that it got reversed. Who knows? But that's not an issue. I understand that. But I still.
But under Gamer, he could.
Yes. I agree with that. But let me also say that I still really think that the core issue here is the classification, and I don't concede that, and I really do think the record is there. So by arguing all these, I'm not waiving that argument. You understand that? Mm-hmm. So that's how the failure to have looked at the net value, the failure to have made factual findings as to whether it was joint debt or not, the failure to have followed the statute by apportioning it, which he doesn't even discuss in his letter of opinion, doesn't even address, and the failure to have applied the same factors in using that debt 50-50, where everything else was 50-50, and applying every other factor. Next issue is a case of first impression. That's the LOD disability payments. It's our position that this is in the nature of a personal injury suit under 20-1073H. And that it's a disability. It's his personal injury suffered during the career that he had in the NFL. And the process of going through it, you know, you have to have an application, the medicals, you have to go through a committee. Ultimately, Roger Goodell, as chair of the NFL, has to approve it. But ultimately, it's based on his injuries. It's not to reimburse for medicals. It's not to reimburse for wages. And it's not a substitute for pension. And I want to really focus on that. They have cited Navis and another case, Vanekin or something like that. Those are cases where in a traditional pension situation, you can elect, instead of taking a full pension, either all or part of a disability. And the advantage is because you don't pay taxes on it, just like the military. That's what happened in those cases. That was at the time that those people elected to take a disability part of a pension. Here, he gets this now as a repayment for his injuries. And he's still going to get his pension at age 55. He's 45 now. So it's not a pension. It's for injuries, and clearly the nature of it is more applicable to the personal injury reimbursement. The fact that the amount may be based on how many years he has is just how they figure out the value of what your injury personal to you is. The record was uncontradicted that there was no repayment out of that for any of the elements of our statute that say, you know, if it's marital funds that have been used to pay medical bills or that there's been a loss of wages, you know, affecting the economics of the family, that's the marital share. The only case that I could find on point is the Wright case out of North Carolina. And it's basically what I would ask this court to look at and to follow, because the same thing happened. The trial court said, I think this is a pension. And the Court of Appeals in North Carolina, our sister state, said, no, it's really in the nature of a personal injury. We're going to remand it back to figure out what parts of the elements. They basically had the same kind of a hybrid look at it like we do, where it's going to be based on personal suffering, wages, and medical bills. Now, at the record, in that case, they probably didn't have that at the record level. In our case, we do. So I think clearly this should be classified because it's not substituting as a pension. The court was absolutely wrong on that. The plan shows it. The documents show it. The testimony shows it. And the Wright case is consistent. It's the only case that I could find that is specifically on point on the LOD.
The LOD benefits, those continued, is it to a maximum of 90 months?
Yes, he received $52.50 or something a month that went into an account. I think it's $56.08. There's a small balance of $18,000 and everything else in there, it's in the record, no question about it. It'll terminate at a defined date based on the value of that injury to him, which will terminate way before he starts getting his pension in age 55, which is, we've already agreed on that. It's going to be a prim formula. So she's already getting her pension. So this is not in the nature of a pension, and the trial court clearly erred as a matter of law in defining that as a pension. It just isn't.
Humor me on this. How is this not like Ascari versus Ascari? That's the VDOT one.
It's the same thing, though. I think he elected to take a disability in lieu of a regular pension, as opposed to getting a disability as a disability payment.
And I mean, it was considered a line of duty.
A line of duty is still based on totally injured, you know, at a high level, at significant injuries. And therefore, that it's a personal injury. It's actually a recovery because of your injuries, as opposed to a pension where, in Ascari or the other cases, you had an election to either get the pension or take a disability to substitute that income. We're not substituting income down here for pay, where you do it when you get a disability like Ascari in these other cases. You have an election to get a disability in lieu of your normal pension because it replaces that income, and the advantage is it's non-taxable as well as reflecting the fact you were injured. So it's completely different. And that's the key that I hope you'll focus on, because that's a different animal. It's a different pension. And the last issue, I'll just very briefly, I know I'm into my rebuttal, is the double dip on the income. Assuming the court made the proper classification of 5889, and assuming that there's no lien on it, and assuming all these other things, what Judge Johnson basically did is to say, I'm giving her half all this, which clearly generated half of about $80,000 or $90,000 on his income statement, which generates $40,000 to her, but he's made findings that he based the award of $3,000, whatever it was, of spousal support on the income that he forgot is going to be shifted to her. She'll have over $4,000 more a month, or about $40,000 a year on that income, because that's what was the substantive amount on his income statement that was generated by those two accounts. And that's confirmed also by, if you look at all of those 7213 and 5889 account statements from 04 up, every month there was a $1,500 amount out of one of them.
Counsel, and
those are all income that was...
Counsel, let me stop you. I know your time's very valuable, but it's highly likely that we might agree that there might be some substance to the argument that you have in reference to that as far as the calculation. But it also means that when it goes back, if it goes back, that you would also, the judge would not only all these other issues that may or may not need to be calculated or recalculated, but it would also mean that he would recalculate
absolutely
the spousal support and of course the child support, all those things, and that could go up or that could go down.
Absolutely, I agree that once there's a reversal of ED, which is a factor of support, it's like dominoes, and it would have to be all reviewed. So you could say, we're not going to rule on it because it's going to be reversed anyway, but I think it should be addressed so that we don't have another double dip issue. And you could just say, you know, even though we find that this was, I mean, I that's about as clear an error as I can think.
Well, but in Robinson, didn't the court say that because we reversed on ED, we remanded it for consideration of the issue of support, and we didn't rule precisely on the...
That's what we're...
I mean, isn't that the cleanest and
yes,
under the case
yes.
law,
yes.
the cleanest way to do that?
And that's consistent for many years of precedent.
Right, so we can't really change that.
Well, no. If you want to just say you figure out support based on this new stuff, and we'll see what he does, and if he's still in error, that's a different issue. But you're correct. I think we've had a long history of cases that say that. So I agree.
Thank you.
I'm going to reserve my other couple minutes. Oh, wait a minute. Well, let me just finish. I might as well just finish up. And I only got 2 minutes.
I'll concede to Susan Counsel.
I'm going to address his cases.
Careful, if you take a step back, he's right behind your knees.
None of them have supporting authorities under Rule 5A 20E, in my opinion. There's on his lack of income, he says that it was irrefutable that my client had all this cash that was disclosed. I've cited every part in there where Mr. Henderson says no. I disclosed all of it. It's shown under sports marketing. That's evidence from which a court could make a finding, which is a trier of fact issue. You mentioned that many times this morning in other cases. On the issue of the value of the B&H properties. Again, there was no opinion of value in there. To say that a financial statement is opinion of value when Mr. Henderson, who's the owner, said it's underwater. It was shown on both of our initial pleadings, property sheets as being underwater. And he said, I think it's worth X amount, and there's a lien, and it's underwater. The fact that there was a two-year-old reference in a deposition to an appraisal, the appraisal wasn't admitted. He's not an expert, obviously wasn't even proffered to be admitted. It was just a statement that somebody had done an appraisal in 2014 and there was no motion for an earlier trial date. So that's no error. The daycare is bogus because the facts show that she wasn't working full-time, which was the basis of that. One of the kids was 15, didn't need it. She worked in the home. She didn't know, and she said, I don't know what I'm going to be doing in the future, if I'm going to need it or not, because I don't know what my plans are. And that's what her testimony was. And I forgot the fact that Mr. Henderson, under the new consent order, is going to have half the time with the kids. And he said, I plan on exercising it. And finally, she says in the record, it's in the brief, isn't it a good idea that Mr. Henderson watches his kids as opposed to some third party? Wouldn't that be a good idea? And she said, sure. So for the court to have found that there was no daycare in the consideration of child support is not an abuse of discretion. There's evidence in there. And then the first error about this concussion thing, it was not proffered properly. We never saw this letter of whatever was alleged, and I've addressed the issue of proffering and the fact that it was not new evidence. It was known for a year and a half that could have been discovered. They didn't ask him one question at the trial on that, which they could have and maybe should have. But it never came up until this later motion. And so when they made the motion to deny the reconsideration, he didn't rule on that because that's not a reconsideration since it had never been addressed earlier. So that's our point. I'll rely on my briefs. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Mr. Goff, you may stand again without sitting down for 25 minutes.
I apologize.
Don't.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is James Goff. I'm here on behalf of the appellee on the initial case before this court for Brigitta Henderson, and where she stands as appellee in the companion case. I will address, with the court's permission, the 15 minutes I've reserved for rebuttal, or for response, rather, to Mr. Deal's argument on behalf of the appellant.
And honestly, Mr. Goff, we don't quibble with any way you want to divide your 25 minutes. It matters not to us, so.
Thank you.
Handle however you choose.
With that being said, I understand that there are 11 issues of error assigned by the appellant in this matter. I break them down into four categories, I think, which are beneficial for the review here today. The first of which, the first four errors assigned, involve the classification of these bank accounts and the transfer of the funds and how we came up with the idea that the court found that there was that they were not separate and could offer no distinction other than that they were marital. The second assignment of error, I think, is assignment 5, 7, 8, and 9, which deal with the $1 million equity line through Wells Fargo. The third is the line of disability benefits, which is in the brief submitted by the appellant. Argument that the line of disability is not marital. The fourth involves their 10th assignment of error, which is regarding the child support and spousal support findings and rulings by the court. And then the last one, the 11th, is attorney's fees, which I don't think is all that material here today for our purposes. Turning to the first set, which is the classification of the accounts, I feel like there's been a bit of a three-card Monte that counsel tried in lower court and again here today. With that being said, there are some very specific points that are noted in the appendix on dates and amounts of these accounts. With that being said, we have a marital date in July of 1999. If you look at the account from which the funds initially were generated, it's a First Union account ending in 0410. On that, shortly before the marriage, on April 1st, 1999, and this is referred to in the appendix on page 2675, the balance in that account was $440,000, clearly separate. Parties didn't marry until 3 months later. In the intervening 3 months, however, before they married in July of 1999, there was a deposit of $842,000. And where those funds came from, which the appellant does not really address and was not addressed at trial, but was addressed by this counsel on behalf of my client, was that those funds came from a bonus that Mr. Henderson received shortly before the parties married, but that was provided to him pursuant to an agreement he signed with the Green Bay Packers in April of 1999 for prospective employment. The $1.2 million in this contract is set forth on page 1546 in the appendix, called for a $1.2 million bonus for playing years 99, 2000, and 2001. The evidence that was trial that the seasons don't start until the summer, which is the time of the marriage of the party. So it was a prospective amount of monies that Mr. Henderson received, which was to be earned during the party's marriage. If there's any question as to why these were paid early and whether they should be considered separate, specifically in that contract signed by Mr. Henderson in April of 1999, which is set forth on page 1546, there is a clawback provision. I believe it's a 2 or 3 page agreement that he signed, which says if you don't play in 99, 2000, or 2001, you will pay back all or a portion of the unearned bonus. So the bonus was earned during the marriage, the entirety of the marriage between the parties. So back to how this account was formed and then later drained. In June of 1999, the monies went in, and then the monies were then transferred into a different account, leaving $138,000 in change. What happened with the $842,000 and the one point, it was set into another account with some additional funds from that account, because at that point, prior to the transfer, the account had $1,280,000 in it. It went in and set up the new account with $1.15 million. From that point forward, you have a gap of 5 years of no records. So when counsel comes before you and says, well, the presumption that it's marital doesn't apply because it was all separate, that's not the case. What you have is the appellant, Mr. Henderson, coming forward and saying, in 2004, when everybody certainly found the records, we have these balances totaling $2.6 million. Now, we're asking you to take a leap of faith because our accountant can't say where they came from. A representative from Wells Fargo can't say where they came from. Mr. Henderson is not going to deliver any materials to this court. And because all of the earlier documents that you see on the record from 1999 were found by Ms. Henderson when she looked through Mr. Henderson's materials. So without the benefit of her finding that, we would not even have the argument that that was said, that it was marital property as early as the party's marital date. And that goes on with the second assignment of error, the third assignment of error, and we would agree that the accounts themselves in 2004 were still solely in his name, but there's no provision as to where those funds came from. And at that time, the presumption is they're marital, because all of a sudden that number comes up when the parties are married almost 5 years into the marriage. We would agree that the accounts were established prior to the marriage under 0401. He had that before they got married, and that's where the $1.2 million bonus was deposited. However, the source of funds which were transmuted to these other accounts were from that account. There was no distinction made by Mr. Henderson. And that's the three-card Monte that's going on. The remaining three of the four arguments regarding this issue provided by counsel are that, well, it's separate. It's separate funds. It's separate funds. It's separate funds. They couldn't show that it was separate funds. The burden is on them once you come in 2004 and say we've got $2.6 million in an account which has been sitting there for the 5 years of this past marriage. So that's why all four of those arguments would fail. With respect to Mr. Deal's contention that there were no monies going in or out, if you look carefully at the voluminous documents that they put into evidence, there were times in there where there was some monies going in and out, and not just between those two accounts, 5889 and the 3719. There was $250,000 going in, $100,000 going in, money's going out, which were not just linked between those two accounts bouncing back and forth. And this occurred between 2004 and 2013. The distinction has not been made. It really is a muddy mess. And again, we have the three-card Monte saying, well, we're going to argue that this is separate to begin with, and then everything else flows. But they did not reach the burden, did not meet their burden of showing that it was separate. It's Maryland, and it has continued to be Maryland. And that was the ruling of Judge Johnson, which I think is certainly well-founded. With respect to the second issue is the $1 million equity line argued by the appellant. There are four assignments of error taken up with that issue. And what I would say is this. Judge Johnson, in setting forth his opinion, dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's repeatedly on the issues that we bring before you today, including the one regarding the $1 million of equity line. And what he did was he found that it to be marital, but he also found that under 20-107.3A2 that he had the authority. It was not mandated, and it's not required, but he had the authority to determine if it should be, if it was a joint or marital debt. That it was a separate marital debt. He found it to be marital, but then he didn't choose to assign it to Ms. Henderson. Under that section, 107.3A5, he found that it was a burden that was to be borne by Mr. Henderson in its entirety. And that specific subsection of the statute gives the authority of the court to do it. He doesn't even need to go back and review the factors under subsection E. He can do it under A5. And that's what he did. And that's what he noted in his ruling, in his letter opinion, and that's what he noted on the motions to rehear. With respect to the issue on the line of duty, Mr. Deal has relied on the case from North Carolina, Wright versus Wright. That case is easily distinguishable for several reasons. Number one, it's certainly not been recognized by the Commonwealth. But more importantly, it dealt with an issue where the injury occurred post-separation, well after the parties separated, number one. Number two, the reason it was remanded by the court, I presume it was the Court of Appeals, it was in North Carolina because they didn't like the fact that the judge who heard the matter didn't provide an analytical approach in his assessment as to whether or not it was marital or separate, more of a pension or a personal injury. That was not the case here with Judge Johnson. Judge Johnson was very specific in his ruling, stating that he went to the plan. You recall the appellant set forth the player's handbook about what all the provisions were of this plan and said, I found by reviewing the plan, it has the sum of all benefits earned. He also looked at the form in which Mr. Henderson chose to receive his benefit. And more importantly, he noted that it was based on the function of the age, wages earned, and accrued during the marriage. Nothing regarding any substantive or substantial injury by Mr. Henderson. So, as concerned what was disliked by the Court of Appeals in North Carolina, they didn't like the approach. Well, in this case, Judge Johnson followed the approach in an analytical fashion and went back and looked at the handbook and cited it specifically and extensively in his finding that this was a marital asset. And I ask that you treat the line of disability as found by Judge Johnson as a marital asset and divide accordingly with his
finding. What's your position on whether it's a case of first impression in Virginia?
It would be with respect because it's so fact specific to the one we have here, a line of disability, an ex-football player. It would be regarding that type of benefit. It's neither a pension, arguably, or a personal injury case. It's kind of in the middle. And I think what Judge Johnson did in this case was appropriate by going and read the specifics of the plan and how it was to be treated and applied those specifics to how we judge a pension or a marital, being a marital asset. So I think he would have, in his analysis, he is fulfilling what was of concern to the Court of Appeals in North Carolina about the way he approached his finding.
So you wouldn't rely on Asghari, the VDOT case?
I would judge in that I believe that dealt just strictly with the division of a pension, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
With that being said, the last issue brought by Mr. Henderson of any value here today is the issue of the child and the spousal support findings by an assignment in the gross income used by the judge to decide those two figures. I would agree with Mr. Deal that those are going to have to be, if there's any change on either that of Mr. Henderson
or that of Ms. Henderson, we're going to have to go back and recalculate both series of guidelines pursuant to 108.2 and 107.1. With that being said, I ask the court to consider that there was no testimony received at trial, or any evidence for that matter, as to how the distributions would be credited, received, or drawn by Ms. Henderson if she was to receive any apportionment of those accounts. Judge Johnson said it was going to be 50-50, but there's no indication that the interest in the dividends received by Mr. Henderson would transfer in an even division to her or anything like that. It was kind of an afterthought. There was simply no evidence produced at trial, only an argument made in post-trial motions. In the absence of any distinction or any information available to the trial court, the court correctly ruled in not including it in income. With respect to the issue concerning, and this gets into now the argument presented by Ms. Henderson, she has four issues before this court. I'm going to kind of walk myself back into the child support and spousal support that she has. With respect to the work-related child care costs, first thing I'd ask you to consider is that Judge Johnson imputed income to Ms. Henderson with the assumption she's not going to be able to do the part-time work because she can't be even with whatever amount of spousal support and the equal distribution. She's not going to be able to rely and live on $9,000 or $10,000 a year in income. So in doing that, we specifically put into the record, into evidence on page 1303 through 1304 of the appendix, that she would need $1,500 per month as work-related daycare costs if forced to go out and work a full-time job. That amount was unchallenged, uncontested, unrebutted by Mr. Henderson. It stands there as a sole statement of fact and evidence. And if you're going to impute income, it implies and it requires that you are going to be out making that amount, working 40 hours a week, and she's going to need to use those and have those funds for the benefit of the two children. You've got a 14-year-old boy, 15-year-old boy now, 14 at the time, who mom had testified needs some degree of supervision, as I think all of us could agree on a 15-year-old boy. And we have an 11-year-old daughter. Even if it's not only the supervision aspect of it, it is that they're going to school, extracurricular activities, sports events, sports practices. There is a lot of driving that is dependent not only on an adult being there, but somebody with a driver's license and somebody that can take the child while mom is out working. It clearly is a work-related daycare expense. And if you're going to impute income and run the numbers with her at least 23.5, as Judge Johnson did, I would suggest that 108.2 would require that you impute the daycare cost as well. So I think that was proper finding by the judge. With respect to the BHB development, the case of Hayes versus Green, which was quoted in our brief, is very clear that a layman, an owner of property, whether it be personal or real, can testify as to its value and ownership. As Mr. Deal noted, 40% of BHB was acknowledged by Mr. Henderson to be his interest. He testified at depositions. When I showed him the, or at least advised him that there had been an appraisal for $1.6 million value of the property, known as the School Street property, in 2014, he said, yeah, that's right. I think that's that amount. Furthermore, pursuant to discovery, we were able to get documentation evidencing the balance sheets for BHB through the close of calendar year 2015. No further supplementation was provided by Mr. Henderson. Those documents, which are owner documents of BHB, of which Mr. Henderson is a 40% owner, show that there is a capital balance of $400,000. Mr. Deal makes issue with the fact that it was over or under, but the balance sheet as of 12/31/2015 show otherwise. There's about a 1.250 mortgage on the property in question with a 1.6 valuation, a couple other small pieces of credits and debits, but that's how you get to the $400,000 valuation, of which 40% is $160,000. Very clear. It was never contested by Mr. Henderson, never challenged, and in fact, I believe we cited a case in the brief which said where you have an individual who provides information about the value of a company, the court actually took that value, even though later on at trial the individual said, I don't believe that's the value anymore, and the court still said, that's the value. By a layperson. So I think under Hayes versus Green, we certainly have shown the value of BHB, the marital share of it, and the interest that should be awarded, or at least considered to be awarded by Judge Johnson. I will tell you there was a motion for an alternate valuation date. Mr. Henderson, strike that. Mr. Deal indicated there was not, but there was one filed under 20-107.3, I believe it's subsection A of the first section, for an alternate valuation date. So we are in good standing for the court, the trial court, to go back and look at these values from 2015 and the $1.6 million valuation from the end of 2014. With respect to the NFL concussion claim, I'd ask the court to consider the arguments that were made at trial and that the court noted several times in its letter opinion with respect to the conduct of Mr. Henderson. He was not candid in some of his production of documents. The court will note that he was turning in documents regarding his income the day of trial, that it was my client that had to find the contract for 1999 through 2001, which had the $1.2 million bonus, which was the foundation upon which the 2.6 everybody's arguing about to show that it was, in fact, marital. He just didn't produce documents. We go through depositions, and these are set out in appendix pages 2045 through 2064. When questions about the NFL, I'm not involved. Oh, I had a claim in Florida, a claim in California. It's void. For later on, I have no involvement presently in NFL concussion litigation. It was only after we concluded trial in November of 2016 that Ms. Henderson, again exercising due diligence, over and above, which is required for her, because these are materials that are supposed to be in her husband's possession, found a letter, and I believe it was issued after the court's ruling, showing that Mr. Henderson was scheduled to receive $1.9 million as part of the NFL settlement concussion.
Counsel, how is the record sufficient for us to make that kind of a determination as to whether the trial court erred?
In terms of
the concussion claim.
Well, two
reasons. You're arguing essentially after discovered evidence, right?
I am, which is allowed on post-trial motions, which I did make, and the court on all counsels and parties' motions said I'm not going to touch anything at this point. But as that's the way I would answer that question. But I'd also note to the court, Mr. Deal notes that it wasn't properly maintained or brought to the court's attention. I proffered it on the motion to reconsider. It was not contested. It was not challenged. I advised the court of exactly what was happening, and therefore it was properly placed in the record, and I would suggest to the court that the failure of Judge Johnson to consider it as part of equitable distribution, it was after discovered, it was relevant to issues of equitable distribution, it should have been considered, and he chose not to do so on a number of issues, including this one. We think that's error, which should be sent back to the court for consideration. With respect to the attorney's fees that I've asked for, I will let the record and the argument speak for itself, but note that this is a case where, although it was granted on no-fault grounds, that was done at counsel's urging and request of client for the benefit of the children. But Mr. Henderson, for the purposes of 107.3, did acknowledge and agree that there were multiple cases of adultery in this case, which continued through the day of trial. Any questions from any counsel? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Goff. We'll come down to Greek counsel, and then the court will be in recess.